We are talking once again with Jo Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and happy birthday.
And happy birthday to you, too, Jo.
Yeah, we're both Scorpios, which should come as no surprise to our long-term listeners.
What's the surprise is that we get along.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it helps that you're physically separated now.
Or at least we pretend to on the radio. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, the things I could tell people.
You know, as long as we keep those checks coming, we expect the silence.
Yeah.
I hope I've earned those checks. Okay, enough.
Just keep doing nothing.
All right, so City Council.
Let's get into the chuckle fest that is the week's news.
Yes.
Yeah,
the
City Council member Teresa Mosqueda, who's chair of the Budget Committee, she released her balancing package for the 2021 budget. She took all of the amendments that got at least three sponsors among the other City Council members, and tried to fit in as many as she could into the balancing package for the budget. And this coming Wednesday and Thursday, November 18th and 19th, the Council Budget Committee is going to sit down and vote on the various amendments one by one included in Mosqueda's package. Also, council members can revive any amendments that Mosqueda dropped out of the package as long as they have a funding source for that, for the money required for that amendment. Which they didn't have to include when they first proposed that amendment for Mosqueda's consideration. Then on Monday, the 23rd, that's the following week, the full council will vote to approve the 2021 budget. And, you know, there may be some last-ditch proposals that make it into the budget, although usually those are just cleanup measures to fix problems with amendments passed by the committee the week before, maybe fix wording or fix the intention of some of them. Now, Mosqueda's presentation to the council this week classified the amendments into four categories: economic recovery, health and safety, housing, and resources. So those are the big, broad categories that she thought were very important to group the amendments under. And I'm just going to take them one group at a time here. So just a little reminder to everybody, the mayor's proposed budget, which is what they're starting from, had something like an $8.8 million shortfall, which is very similar to the revised 2020 budget, which had several million dollars shortfall. And Mayor Durkan just kind of left that for the city council to clean up. She did it once again with the 2021 budget. In total, the council's amendments will move around about $83 million inside the mayor's proposed budget, including replenishing the emergency reserves by about $32 million, whereas the mayor's budget would have drained them down to almost zero. And the reason that they can do that, the city council could do that, could put money back into the emergency reserves, is because they got some good news this week. The city budget office released the November revenue forecast showing that the city will be taking in $36 million more in revenue this year than they estimated in October for the general fund. And that next year it's projected that the city will collect $32.6 million more in revenue over the estimate that was used for the mayor's budget. That's money coming from property taxes, sales and use taxes, and the business and or B&O tax revenue. Now, that really points to the fact that our local economy is doing pretty well, even though there are definitely some sectors that are really suffering, like restaurants, retail, the arts, and the tourism industry. Now, that extra $68 million is going to help fill a lot of holes in the budget. And it means that layoffs in some departments, like the Human Services Department, the Office of Economic Development, the Seattle Department of Transportation, the Seattle Fire Department, et cetera, won't be happening. They were cuts that were included in Durkan's budget, and the council took some of that extra revenue that the city is expected to collect, and they filled those holes and are keeping those people employed. On the other hand, some of the non-general fund revenue that would ordinarily go to the Seattle Department of Transportation is lagging the October forecast. So some of the amendments, particularly the ones listed under economic recovery, the first category, will fill in holes in the transportation budget. That includes about $24.8 million that voters just approved with the City of Seattle Proposition 1 to renew the Seattle Transportation Benefit District. Now, remember when we looked at the mayor's budget a few weeks ago, Durkin had avoided deeply cutting most areas of the budget, except the two very heavy capital, the two departments that have a lot of property and infrastructure in the city that require a lot of capital investments. That's the Transportation Department and the Parks Department. So in the balancing package that the council just drafted, almost $43 million will go into the Seattle Department of Transportation to fill some of the holes in the transportation budget. There aren't any amendments really to fill the holes in the Parks Department budget, unfortunately. In addition, the balancing package will restore funding for several capital projects in the transportation department, like the Thomas Street redesign on the east side of the Seattle Center, money for the Route 44 and Route 7 transit corridors, funding for the Georgetown to South Park Trail, $400,000 for protected bike lanes, and $4 million for a survey of the city's bridges to try to identify which ones are most critically in need of bridge maintenance. And of course, that's just a tiny drop in the bucket of what the city's bridges need. Overall, the Seattle Department of Transportation spends about $6.6 million on bridge maintenance per year when it really needs to spend at least $34 million. So we're way underfunding that, and we're getting no money from the federal government for that, at least under the Trump administration. And this week, I should say, too, three of the city council members are backing a car tab fee for bridge maintenance. That was Alex Peterson, chair of the Transportation Committee, who proposed that, and Lisa Herbold and Andrew Lewis both signed on to it. So that could get added into the budget this week as well. And since the funding source is there, they don't have to take the money from anywhere else. That's a $20 car tab fee that they're proposing is projected to raise about $3.6 million next year for bridge maintenance. Again, still just a tiny drop in the bucket, which means the city should be working with the federal government and the state government to try to find more funds for that. And I should point out, too, that is not an increase in people's car tab taxes. People's car tab taxes are now in the city of Seattle at $80, and they will actually expire. The $60 portion that the city collects will actually expire at the end of the year. So car tabs are set to go down to $20. So adding this additional $20 fee will put them at $40, half of what people are paying right now. Now, under the second category in the budget, health and safety, are amendments for climate policy, food access, and for health services, including a proposal that's gotten a lot of controversy in the mainstream media here, a little over $1 million to fund what are called drug user health services. In other words, providing safe consumption sites inside existing health clinics that service the community of folks who are drug dependent in the city of Seattle. But not, and that money had been allocated in the prior 2 years to try to build a safe consumption site inside the city of Seattle. But that has run into a lot of pushback from the business community and from more conservative Seattleites. And so that money was never actually spent. I think Durkin also resisted wanting to spend that money, too. But here, in this budget, the city council is saying, okay, let's just give that money to public health clinics and have them spend it on providing resources for the drug-dependent community. Now, this part of the balancing package, the health and safety package, also includes investments in BIPOC communities that are identified in three subcategories: equitable access, community-led investments, and the biggest subcategory called finding alternatives to policing. This is where the cuts to the Seattle Police Department are listed. Overall, about a 20% cut in funding is allocated for the police department, although most of that is shifting personnel into other departments and relying on attrition and cuts to overtime spending, and then also harvesting a few small cuts here and there to things like equipment purchases, to travel and training outside of Washington State, for example. Now, some of the funding for BIPOC communities includes things like a little over $500,000 for a study on the needs of Black girls and young women and Black queer and transgender youth, $130,000 for a new Indigenous Advisory Council, and $1.7 million for services to Native Americans, $30 million restored for the Strategic Investment Fund, which was originally funded from the Mercer Megablock sale and then cut, and then those funds were cut and moved around by Mayor Durkan. $30 million for participatory budgeting, $10 million for community-led public safety investments to be funded through the Human Services Department, and $1.6 million for organizations providing alternatives to the criminal justice system and for restorative justice program. Now, in the housing portion, so those are the specific items for funding for the BIPOC community that the city council is adding to the budget on top of what is already in there. Now, in the housing portion of the balancing package are several amendments, including a little over $1 million to fund coordination of homelessness outreach to replace the old navigation team with a team of 8 people who would coordinate with nonprofit organizations outside of the city government to provide outreach to homelessness, to people suffering homelessness. There's $1 million for a mobile crisis team, money for hygiene services, including trash pickup and publicly accessible sinks for hand washing, $655,000 for 24-hour operations at emergency shelters, $2.8 million to expand tiny home villages, plus $1.4 million to open a temporary tiny home village in the U District while an affordable housing site is being redeveloped there to house those folks. And $750,000 to increase rapid rehousing services. There's also money for tenant outreach, organizing, and legal services, including eviction defense, and about $2.5 million in additional money for low-income housing services, including the Home and Hope program, the Home for Good program, the Aurora Commons redevelopment project, and development inside the Central District. Now, that's the big sort of core of the budget rebalancing package, is allocating a whole lot more money that Mayor Durkan didn't put to fund programs that the council had started funding in the last year or two. Durkan cut funding for a bunch of those programs, and the city council reached into her pool of her little slush fund of $100 million for BIPOC communities, and they reallocated amongst a bunch of different things in order to fund programs they had started in prior years and to specifically fund programs for BIPOC people that have already been identified but that Durkan had not funded. Now, the resources section of the balancing package, that's the final section, lists where most of the funding sources are, which are a combination of the new revenue identified by the November revenue forecast, money shifted from Mayor Durkan's $100 million slush fund for BIPOC communities, and small cuts in other parts of the budget, and various housekeeping amendments to shift money from programs where it can't be spent because of COVID-19, a hiring freeze at the Seattle Police Department, and other factors. Now, overall, the council is cutting $70 million from Durkan's $100 million slush fund and allocating a total of $80 million in additional funding for BIPOC communities. In addition, the council has proposed a proviso or restriction on the remaining $30 million in the mayor's slush fund. And the proviso says, quote, none of the money so appropriated may be spent until authorized by further ordinance, end quote. So essentially what that says is that the council is telling the mayor, you can't spend that money unless you draft a bill for us to review, amend, and pass through city council. Now, the proviso goes on to require that the mayor show that her task force has actually worked with the folks doing participatory budgeting to identify who will get that funding so that there's not duplication or that the two groups are not working at cross purposes. And while that seems like it might be geared to antagonize Mayor Durkan, she actually came out this week and praised the city council for the work that they've done so far on the budget. And that might seem surprising, right? Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, it's not really that surprising. When you think about how Durkan has been tending to do her job, she delegates a lot of stuff. She definitely does not micromanage things, and often work that she should be doing falls through the cracks. That's kind of to put it nicely. And we can really see the council working very hard to figure out how all of the money should be spent and allocated well and responsibly, as well as plugging a shortfall that Durkan left in the budget, apparently unknowingly left in the budget. And Durkan, of course, might be feeling a sense of relief that she actually doesn't have to do this hard work, even though her job requires her to do it. so that's really
very
kind
tactfully
of,
stated.
I know, that's kind of the nice way to put it, but, you know,
so
what can
so,
you say?
So do these council amendments have the necessary votes to override a line item veto from the mayor?
What do you mean a line item veto?
Well, she's certainly gone through with the council's budget and decided, you know, not to spend certain money or to spend money the council didn't authorize. I mean,
yeah,
she's done a lot of that.
That's not a line item veto because she doesn't have that power. She can.
Yeah, effectively it is though.
She can veto the entire budget, or she can just choose to not act on their request, which I think is what you're asking, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll just have to see. I mean, that's the way it's been in the past, is the council passes the budget and then the mayor just kind of, Mayor Durkan just kind of selectively decides what she's going to spend and what she isn't going to spend. And there really isn't a great way for the city council to force her to spend that money.
I'm thinking that's what the requirement of an authorization for an additional legislation came from. Yeah.
That
frustration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll see if Mayor Durkan follows that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fallback really is the city council would have to try to remove her from office, and that's a heavy lift, I think. Especially,
well, it's not going to happen in an election year either. So.
Yeah, no, and especially
we'll elect a new mayor next year, and the reports are that she is not planning to run for re-election, which is a huge relief.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see who runs.
We'll see. She hasn't made an official announcement yet.
No, and I was expecting that to come any time after election day. So it's the time of year.
Yeah, we'll see. And so I doubt the city council would move forward on something like that when it is possible that 2021 could be her last year in office, but also because Mayor Durkan and her supporters have been waging this long campaign to undercut the city council in the press, including, I think just this last week, we saw the Downtown Seattle Association and the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce funding a poll by EMC Research to, you know, try to find out if people have confidence in the city council or not. And the questions, I looked at that poll and the questions were very leading.
Shocked.
Yeah. No, I mean, the questions were really kind of geared to make the respondent feel like, oh my God, maybe the city council is out of control and doing a terrible job. So of course you kind of get the answers you expect when you ask questions like that.
Right.
And in addition, EMC Research didn't release any demographics of who they talked to, which really makes me suspicious that maybe the only people they talked to were people over the age of 40 or over the age of 50.
Right. With landlines.
Yeah, with landlines. So. So I have no confidence in that poll. It really was sort of a push poll to try to change the attitudes of Seattle residents, I think, towards the city council.
David Croman, who writes for Crosscut, had commented earlier in the week when that survey came out. He said it seemed highly he didn't say highly unusual. He said it was unusual for a survey to come out about just the city council and not also include
the mayor.
The mayor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, so you know these are the mayor's supporters who are pushing this narrative that the city council is the one who's not doing their job, that the mayor's actually doing a great job, when in fact I would say it's really the reverse.
All right. Anything else on that particular balancing?
No. I do want to say, too, people are probably asking themselves, because if we remember the city council considering the 2020 revised budget, they may be asking themselves why there's no additional funding in the 2021 budget for COVID-19 relief. And I just want to say that, you know, for the 2020 revised budget, the city council added a bunch of relief money, and they also passed the Jumpstart tax bill, which is set to take in a bunch of money in the first year or two, specifically for COVID-19 relief. So there's not a whole lot of additional other general fund money in the 2021 budget being moved into that. But there's another reason, too, why the city council didn't dig deeper for COVID-19 relief, and that's primarily because Joe Biden was elected president this past week, not Donald Trump. And in a way, it doesn't really matter who controls the Senate, the National Senate, as long as Trump is not in the White House. We saw right before the election Nancy Pelosi working really, really hard to get a deal struck with the Republicans in the Senate, and she was very close. And she even worked with Steven Mnuchin in Trump's cabinet and was very close to getting a deal for a bill on COVID-19 relief. And then Donald Trump stepped in and stopped it, essentially. Trump could also try to be a spoiler this next year, even though he's not in the White House anymore. But he's not going to be able to directly stop a deal between Democrats in the House and Republicans in the Senate. That's not going to be possible. In addition, I think the Democrats have a very good chance of winning those two seats in Georgia on January 5th. And we're just going to have to see in early January, late December and early January, which party is more capable of turning out their voters and which party is putting more resources into turning out their voters in the state of Georgia for those two runoff Senate elections.
Yeah, there's been a huge amount of Republican money that's already gone into that race, so we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm kind of skeptical that the Democrats can win both seats. I think it's more likely that Loeffler will lose, but Perdue will win. And because the Republicans have a powerful argument, you know, do you want the socialist Democrats to control the White House and both houses of Congress?
The Democrats haven't really addressed that. They've just ignored it.
Yeah, and I'm skeptical that they'll be able to win both Senate seats, but I hope so, but we'll see.
Yeah, but you know that those two races also are really, really important for helping to determine whether county governments and municipal governments like the city of Seattle can get funding for huge transportation projects like the replacement or repair of the West Seattle Bridge. Or our big regional transit projects like light rail, also important for things like bike lanes, traffic safety, and other transportation needs.
I think the most important thing in the Georgia race in particular is going to be COVID relief.
And that too.
You know, the Democrats really ought to be emphasizing that and health care.
Yes, I think so too. So that wraps up my discussion of the budget. There was some other interesting news this week locally. This week, Mayor Durkin and Councilmember Lisa Herbold, who is chair of the Public Safety Committee, announced a major change in who gets to sit at the negotiating table when the city bargains a new contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild. So instead of just representatives of the mayor's office and the city's labor relations policy committee, you know, which is not, which is a department of the city government under Mayor Durkan, there will be members of the three oversight bodies created by the council's 2017 police accountability ordinance sitting at the negotiating table. That means that for the first time, representatives from the Office of Police Accountability, the Office of the Inspector General for the Seattle Police Department, and the Community Police Commission will also be at the negotiating table. This is a big one, really. And this is the first time that members representing the community will have input into the police union contract. In addition, a member of the Seattle City Council's central staff will also be present at the negotiations. The council, this is also pretty big. The council will no longer have to rely solely on secondhand information from the mayor's office about the union contract and the intent behind provisions of the union contract. That's really big. Negotiations, of course, are still going to be confidential and not open to the public, and that's a requirement of state labor law. The city can't change that, but this is, I think, a really important big step that the city has taken, and a very positive one.
Yeah.
To, I think, to really ensure that the Seattle police unions will accept and adhere to the oversight features within the 2017 police accountability ordinance that the council passed.
Yep, that's good news for sure.
So very good news there.
All right, well.
We're not used to good news.
That's our good news item for the week.
Yeah. We need to preserve that. Let's move on back to our usual bad news mode. And how about some updates on what is going on with COVID?
Well, as bad as you might think it is from the media, it's actually worse. The numbers in Washington State have doubled in the last 2 weeks, and that includes in King, Pierce, and Snohomish County. We've got Governor Inslee took to the airwaves Thursday evening, and aside from encouraging people to not travel or have get-togethers for Thanksgiving, but, you know, do it via Zoom, basically. He intimated that there would be additional statewide restrictions coming in the next few days. One of those got announced yesterday in conjunction with the governors of Oregon and California to discourage interstate travel at this point, which, again, is aimed squarely toward the holidays and family get-togethers. Oregon also announced a two-week lockdown.
I think it's also an acknowledgement that California's COVID cases are just soaring out of control, more so than anywhere else on the West Coast.
Yeah, California became the second state this week to reach 1 million confirmed cases, which isn't good. You know, Texas is worse and it has a smaller population, but still. Yes, on the West Coast, California is clearly the problem area. Oregon has been logging record numbers of cases, and as I said, Washington's caseload has doubled in the last 2 weeks, which is roughly similar to what we've seen nationally, where you know, the overall number of confirmed cases, each new confirmed cases each day, reached 181,000 yesterday, and it was only last week that it reached 100,000 for the first time. So that's also, you know, doubling in a very short period of time. And, you know, if you extrapolate that out, we've got another 8.5 weeks before Donald Trump is out of office. 9.5 weeks. And, you know, that we could be reaching 1 million cases a day by the time he's out of office, if we assume that his administration is going to continue to do absolutely nothing to try and stem the pandemic. It's going to get very, very bad over the next 2 months and over the holidays. And that includes in Washington State. And again, wear face masks, wash your hands, socially distance. We know these things in combination work. Yeah. It's just a question of getting people to actually do it.
I think the issue here in Washington State is that people are thinking, okay, it's time. It's been 9 months. I'm tired of this. I'm going to relax. You know, restaurants are opening for indoor dining, that means I can just go back to life as usual.
Yeah, and, well, the restaurants are going to close next week, I think.
Yeah, the CDC has been saying, look, you know, and studies have been showing, look, you know, the most common places where clusters arise are from indoor dining at restaurants and coffee shops, people visiting gyms.
And bars, yeah.
Yeah, people visiting gyms and clusters at schools and campuses. And that's not good news for the winter. You know, people are, as the light gets dimmer, people want to go do things with friends, you know,
and they're indoors because it's cold outside.
Exactly. And then that's not boding well for the upcoming holidays with kids returning from college campuses to their families. That's going to be a major vector of spread, I think, in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and as nationally, we're starting to see shortages of PPEs here in Western Washington as well, particularly for healthcare providers and at nursing homes and other places where they're necessary. So, you know, if you're hoarding N95 masks, please don't, because healthcare providers need those.
I found it interesting this week, too, that the CDC finally came out and said that wearing a mask protects the wearer as well as other people, which I think has been obvious for months now.
Well, the CDC issued a number of new guidances this week, and it's almost like, well, now that Trump has lost, you know, we can actually say what we know, you know, because we're not being stopped or we don't care if people are trying to stop us. And the CDC is, and the FDA and the various other regulatory agencies where the scientific process has been interfered with by Trump political appointees who are now looking for other jobs. You know,
many of them have COVID-19 now.
Yeah, well, that's true too.
It's just ravaging the White House, right? With, you know, well over 30 members of Trump's inner staff infected. Including,
we had another super spreader event on election night, which could come as no surprise.
They had an election night party where nobody wore masks.
But the other reason the other reason that's important is because we had a major announcement this week from Pfizer about a potential new vaccine that got a lot of media attention as being positive news. And it is positive news, but it comes with a lot of important caveats. They're in phase 3 trials. All Pfizer said was after 7 days, the thousands of volunteers participating in the trial who took the vaccine had not contracted COVID-19. That's good, but you need to be able to prove that for 28 days. And more importantly, you know, it has to be an effective vaccine, which, we got good news about this week, but it also has to be safe. And the reason you have thousands and thousands of volunteers in these phase 3 trials is so you can look at different demographics or different underlying health conditions and see whether the vaccine is more and or less effective with some of those demographics or whether it has particular side effects that only affect people with particular underlying conditions. So that hasn't been seen yet. We've only seen Pfizer's data. Actually, we haven't even seen the data. We've just seen their press release. Mm-hmm. And this is Big Pharma, remember, and they have a huge, huge incentive for a profit motive on this, for pushing it forward. Oh, yeah. And then there's the problem with this and one of the other vaccines, and now in phase 3 trials, that they have to be transported and stored in extremely cold storage, minus 103 degrees Fahrenheit, which the infrastructure for that doesn't exist. Ordinary refrigerators or freezers in clinics or healthcare hospitals, et cetera, can't do that. So Pfizer says they've developed a box in which it can be safely transported. We haven't seen that either. We're taking Pfizer's word for it. And, you know, there's going to need to be training for untold numbers of healthcare workers, transport workers, et cetera, for how to safely handle this sort of thing. Beyond that, we have the regulatory process and, you know, really until Trump's political appointees are swept out by new Biden appointees, you're going to have an additional layer in states like Washington, New York, California, et cetera, where they've said that they want to independently review the vaccine, before approving it for distribution. Now that that in that additional step is likely to go away once Biden is in office, because the whole point of that was that they did not trust Trump's political appointees not to rush through an unsafe vaccine so that he could take credit for it. So the good news is that these are moving forward, and there are other vaccines in phase three trials that we're going to hear about over the next couple of weeks probably, that are also moving forward. But it's the efficacy in the phase three trials that is really the biggest hurdle for vaccine development. This has been done in record time, and, you know, all the credit to the scientists and the lab rats who've been working on this. But, you know, we're a long way away, probably late spring at the very earliest before this sees widespread distribution as a vaccine.
Yeah, and I think the Pfizer vaccine has that huge hurdle to overcome with distribution and the cold storage issue.
Yeah, and even if it can be overcome in some place like the United States that has a lot of resources, there's still the rest of the world to think about. You know, how is Brazil going to do that? How's India going to do that? How are some of these, you know, very poor countries without much public health infrastructure going to be able to cope with that?
Yeah, not every area in the United States could be considered a developed nation. I should point out. There are some parts of the United States and populations within the United States who are living in underdeveloped world conditions.
And also, you know, who don't have access to hospitals or good primary health care facilities, because they're rural areas, and a lot of hospitals over the last decade have closed in the United States in rural areas. So that's going to be a problem too.
Yeah, I think that distribution hurdle is going to be something that any vaccine has to get over. But when you add the additional feature of special handling, that makes it even harder. And then there's just the getting over the resistance that some Americans will have to getting vaccinated at all.
I was going to mention that next. Yeah. Something like 40% of Americans say they don't plan to take a vaccine. And, you know, I don't know how much of that will change once Biden is in office and you know, it's more clearly a safe and effective vaccine. But a good portion of it won't. The anti-vaccine movement has gotten a lot of momentum this year, you know, underscored by an administration that is virulently anti-science. That's become a mainstream view in the United States, unfortunately. We've become a know-nothing country.
Yeah, and you know, 40% is enough people to mean that a vaccine could be useless in terms of stopping a spread. It might protect individual people, but it won't stop the spread of the virus.
We really need
about 80-90% adherence to vaccines.
And that's going to be a very heavy lift in this country.
Yeah, I think so. And,
you know, especially at this point, because the community spread is so widespread, it's not just one or another particular part of the country. It's everywhere. There's only one state, I believe, right now where the numbers are not rising. And often rising in record levels, something like 35, 36 states are having, you know, routine records almost every day.
Yeah.
And
so Washington State
is one of those.
Yeah, we're not just reaching a second peak. For a lot of states, it's the third peak, and it's the highest of the three peaks right now, which is really alarming. And it's doubly alarming when the person who's supposed to be managing this whole thing is just ignoring it as if it's not existing.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, COVID-19 is ravaging the White House with, you know, 30 members of Trump's inner circle infected, including his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, housing secretary Ben Carson, campaign advisor Corey Lewandowski, Trump's entire press team, it seems like, also 130 members of the Secret Service who trailed Trump on the campaign trail just prior to Election Day. Major members of the Republican campaign committee are infected, and the campaign advisor who's leading Trump's efforts to challenge the election results in several states is also infected.
Although he named Giuliani to head that yesterday, which is not an improvement.
Which is not helpful, no. And many of these folks were infected attending that super spreader event on election night. You know,
and the chair of the quote unquote White House coronavirus task force, Mike Pence, went on vacation.
Yeah, so I think we know that he probably also has it. He's just not saying anything about it. So I think when Trump tweets that the election's being stolen from him, I think he's right that COVID-19 and his own stupidity are actually responsible for stealing the election from him, not the Democrats. But it goes beyond that. I mean, when he's pretending that COVID-19 doesn't exist and his whole team is also infected, it really puts the entire nation under a very high security risk when there's nobody really in charge and nobody really able to do their jobs at the highest level because they're dealing with a pandemic that's ravaging their own ranks.
Yeah. And then we saw he pretty much decapitated the national security leadership this week, replacing people with Trump loyalists who in many cases really aren't qualified to do the jobs and, you know, are only going to have the jobs for a couple months in the first place. So they won't have time to learn it. This really is a leaderless country right now, which is not how a transition is supposed to go. It's supposed to be a smooth transition. And it has been in the past historically. But we've got a man-child in the White House right now who is petulant and pouting and apparently settling scores, and that's really all he's concerning himself with right now.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit, too, about, you know, the election isn't quite over yet, and just to mention some of the dates and some of the process for people who are following it. So what is supposed to be happening right now and is currently happening without a whole lot of interference from the Trump team, fortunately, is that the states are busy certifying their election results. You know, procedures are different in each state, but essentially election officials at state and municipal levels are currently checking to make sure all the ballots have been counted and they're certifying their final tallies. This step is going to include some recounts in some localities and in the entire state of Georgia. Those counties
and Wisconsin also.
Yeah, and Wisconsin is doing a recount. Those county and municipal election officials then will submit their tallies to the top elections official in each state, and usually that's the Secretary of State, but not in every state. Sometimes there's a separate person. Who then will compile the results from each municipality in their state and then present those results to the governor of the state. Then the governors send a vote count and a list of electors to Congress by December 14th. But if they can get it done by December 8th, which is known as the safe harbor deadline, their vote counts are then protected from challenges. This means that if a state delays because of a recount, like Georgia, for example, or because they have a Republican governor maybe who delays actually sending the results on to Congress, their vote count could then be challenged. And the Trump team, that's where the Trump team is entering into this. They're trying to file lawsuits to challenge vote counts and to delay that process. That's so far been really hard to win. The Trump team is finding that their state lawsuits are being thrown out of court in places like Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. So it's been extremely hard for them to file lawsuits to delay that process.
And let's be clear, the reason they're losing those lawsuits, and in many cases they're being thrown out in record time, mm-hmm. is they don't have any actual evidence.
No evidence.
And the Trump lawyers have been forced to admit in court on several different occasions, particularly Arizona and Pennsylvania, that they don't have any evidence. And now you're seeing that major
or that the evidence is hearsay. They don't have, you know, they heard it from a person who heard it from a person, and they don't have any proof it's true.
Yeah. And you're starting to see major Republican law firms refusing to represent the Trump administration in these lawsuits or in any further election legal maneuvering, because they have to, lawyers have to tell the truth under court, and they can be sanctioned for filing frivolous lawsuits, which is what most of these are. So they're shying away from having anything to do with the Trump people at this point, which is an unexpected but welcome development.
Yeah, I think so. Now, the reason why December 14th is the ultimate deadline, December 8th is the safe harbor deadline, December 14th is the final deadline for governors to send the certified vote tallies and a list of electors to Congress is because that's when the Electoral College convenes to meet. If some states have not certified their results by December 14th, then their state legislatures could step in and appoint electors to the Electoral College. And that's what the Trump team's now falling back on trying to urge state legislatures to do that.
However, the New York Times had an article last night where they surveyed the Republican leaders of the legislatures of the various swing states, all of whom said they had no interest in doing that.
Which is
so
great.
So that looks like that's going to be a dead end as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we saw a quote, an anonymous quote, of course, in the Wall Street Journal this week from a White House source saying, you know, I think you guys are vastly overestimating us, you know, in terms of Trump's ability to pull off a coup. They're just not organized. They're incompetent.
Yeah, well, and you add COVID-19 on top of that. They're also sick.
Yeah, and Rudy Giuliani in charge of the lawsuits, and it ain't going to get any better.
No,
so I really think that Trump's efforts, I mean, he started talking, at least internally, according to a lot of reports this week, about running in 2024. Now, that's a good news, bad news kind of thing. The good news is it means he knows he's not going to be president come January. The bad news is that means he's likely to still be a major presence in the Republican Party, and Republican legislators, particularly in Congress, are still going to be fearful of alienating Trump's cult.
I don't think he's going to be healthy in 2024, possibly
in
2024. But I think the real risk comes from his son, Donald Trump Jr., who clearly has political ambitions.
Well, so does Ivanka.
Yeah. But
so does Jared.
Donald
they all want to try and cash in.
Is more vocal and has been more kind of leading a lot of the Trump team's assaults on the electoral process. And I see him as more of a risk. And also, I think he would be more readily adopted by the Republican Party than Trump's sort of dim-witted. I probably shouldn't say that about Ivanka, but she really clearly comes across as not on top of stuff.
Let's make this gender neutral. I think Don Jr. is pretty dim-witted too.
Yeah, true.
But yeah, it's certainly they've certainly all had their eyes on trying to create some sort of a dynasty. And that's likely to be an issue going forward as well. You're right about that.
Yeah. So anyway, on December 14th, when the Electoral College convenes, then the electors cast their votes for president. And there are laws that require the electors to cast their votes for the candidate who won the vote in the state, the overall vote in the state. A lawsuit came out of the faithless electors in 2016 who refused to do that. And it was decided by the Supreme Court that those electors' votes had to then go to candidates that won the popular vote in their state.
There's a caveat to that. Mm-hmm. That wasn't exactly what the Supreme Court ruled. The Supreme Court ruled that if a state had a law requiring that law had to be honored. Only 14 states have that law right now in place, including Washington State. But in the majority of states, including all the relevant swing states, that law doesn't exist. But again, you're not likely to see an organized effort on the scale that would be necessary to overturn the election, because that would have to happen at several different states.
I want to point out too that in those swing states there are more Democratic governors than there are Republican governors, so it's unlikely that a Democratic governor is going to send Republican electors to overturn a popular vote in their state
of the major swing states. The only states that voted for Biden that have Republican governors are Arizona and Georgia.
Yeah, so not enough electoral votes to change the election. Now, the Trump team, again, has been urging state legislatures to, even if the governor does send electors on time to the Electoral College, to go rogue and appoint their own team of electors to go and compete with with the electors sent by the governor. And in that case, what is done is Congress then must decide between the two groups of electors whose votes to count. On January 6th, Congress certifies the results by counting up all the electors' votes. And that's usually a formality, but this year it could be if the Trump team is able to persuade a couple of Republican legislatures, which is turning out so far not to be the case, to send competing electors to the Electoral College, Congress might have to decide. And theoretically, the Democratic-controlled House could choose to honor a governor's slate for Biden, while a Republican-controlled Senate
could choose
to count the pro-Trump slate appointed by a state legislature.
Because that particular vote is done one vote per state delegation. And the Republicans actually control 26 state delegations. So they would have a majority in the House.
I don't know about that.
It is in the Constitution. Sorry.
Okay. So the federal law also requires that Congress should decide in favor of the executive of the state. And that means the governor's pro-Biden slate would be by law, Congress would be required to choose that one over a competing slate by the state legislature. So whatever direction you're approaching it from, that whole idea that the state legislature could send a competing delegation is just not gonna help the Trump team at all, I don't think.
At this point, it looks extremely unlikely.
Unlikely, anyway. And then finally, of course, on January 20th, the new president is sworn in and formally takes office.
Yes, and Trump will be golfing in Mar-a-Lago on that day.
Yeah,
I predict now. Yeah, or setting himself up in a new, plush Dhaka outside Moscow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in addition to his health, the other major impediment to his running in 2024 is going to be his legal issues between now and then, because he's got a whole bunch of investigations that are just waiting for him to leave office, both criminal and civil. And he's going to be spending a lot of his time over the next several years in court, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Let's move along. Let's move along, please. Can we move along quickly? I mean, I really want the next 9 weeks to go quickly.
Uh-huh.
And peacefully.
I mean, the stuff coming out this week about Biden starting to gel the different people, different potential selections for his cabinets and stuff.
Yeah. Keep in mind, this is in spite of the fact that the Trump team is not allowing him to allowing the president-elect to receive national security briefings or information that he really needs to start doing the transition properly.
And that would traditionally would have been occurring by now?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. It would have been. And this is really unprecedented, the fact that the person in the Trump administration who is in charge of overseeing that transition is just resisting completely giving any information to the Biden team, because she, just like Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff, just like Mike Pompeo, just like all the other members of the Trump White House team, they're being forced by Donald Trump's intransigence to assume that Trump is going to have a second term, when in fact that's not the case. And, and I think, too, Biden also, one of the teams that he appointed this week was he just started appointing folks for his climate change crew. I kind of think of them. They're folks who are going to be looking at reinstating by executive, helping him reinstate by executive order some of the regulations that the Trump administration has overturned, something like hundreds of regulations that have been overturned by Donald Trump, environmental regulations that Joe Biden is going to be extremely busy trying to put back into place. And that's going to require a full team of people to work on, in addition to things like rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement.
Yeah, and I saw, I'm back. Mm-hmm. I saw an interview with his new chief of staff, Ron Klain, who said that they've already got a working list of what some of those things will be on the first day, that they're going to try and restore not just the Paris Climate Agreement, but also an awful lot of the overturn a lot of the executive orders that the Trump administration has deregulatory orders that the Trump administration has done, not just over the last 4 years, but specifically over the last month. They've really tried to cram in as much of that as they can on their way out the door.
So events.
Yes.
So this coming week on Wednesday, November 18th, Women in Black are holding a vigil to honor the deaths of homeless Seattleites this year. 13 people have died on the streets of Seattle in just the past 3 weeks. And so far this year, there have been 119 deaths, the highest annual total in prior years has been 120 people. So this year is going to set a very grim record here in Seattle.
Yeah, especially since it's about to get cold.
Yeah, at least 3 of those 13 people died of overdoses. So it really points to the fact that we need safe consumption sites as well as housing for everyone. And I should point out that of those 13 people, 10 of them are people who are over 40 years old and 8 are over 50 years old. One person was in their 80s, and that I think is just criminal.
Absolutely.
So that vigil.
And that problem has just gotten worse over the course of the pandemic.
It certainly has. So that vigil is going to start at noon on Wednesday at Seattle's City Hall. That's at 4th and James Street downtown. So if you want to go join that vigil with Women in Black, I recommend that.
Yep. Across from City Hall and right in front of the municipal court and next door to SPD. So All the relevant agencies. Also, the Daily Morning March and the Daily Evening March are continuing, rain and cold notwithstanding. To find out where people are meeting on any particular day, you can check the Facebook page for Morning March Seattle or on Instagram, all one word, Seattle Evening March. And they post where they're going to be meeting each day. So join with those folks and help those protests out.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, you started out talking about the budgeting dates and amendments that were being added. Is anything coming up this week that people?
Yeah, the 18th and the 19th, the City Council will be voting on individual amendments to include in the budget for those meetings. Folks can check those out online virtually. You go to the City Council website, click on the committees. You can there find a list of the agendas. You can find dates and times. You can sign up for testifying at the virtual meetings. You should sign up ahead of time because there's usually a long list of people who want to testify. And, of course, contact the City Council representative for your district if there's something that you think got dropped out of the budget that should be added back, to let them know that you really support that, or if you think there's an amendment to the budget that will be up for a vote that you think that City Council member should support. You can contact
and
them.
Again, for people who've been advocating defunding SPD, there is a significant defunding of SPD. It's not the 50% the protesters have wanted, but it is significant. And if you have an opinion on that, weigh in, because a lot of people will.
Yeah. And, I think this budget really shows that the City Council is not doing what Mayor Durkin's supporters keep saying that the city council is doing, which is defunding the SPD by 50% without putting alternatives in place. In fact, this budget really puts a lot of alternatives in place, and they're funding a lot of those programs before they're making the major cuts on SPD, which of course is what these city council members have been saying for a long time that they were going to do.
They're actually approaching it far more responsibly than Mayor Durkin is.
I think so.
All right.
Okay.
Well, I guess wraps up another week of.
Yep. So we'll be back next week. Maria will be a year older. and that's not just because of the news. So, we'll be back.
All right. We will talk with you both then.